The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
Namo tasse bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhasse. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhasse. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhasse. Etang santang, etang panitang. Yadidam sabba sankhara samatho sabbopadipati nissaggo annakkhayo virago nirodho nibbana. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, this is the 15th sermon in the series of sermons on Nibbana. Towards the end of our last sermon, we happened to quote a brief exhortation on Dhamma from the Udana, which enabled the ascetic Bahya Dharuchirya to liberate his mind from imaginings and attain the state of non-identification, atammayata or arahanthood. In order to attempt an exposition of that exhortation of the Buddha, which was pithy enough to bring up about instantaneous arahanthood, let us refresh our memory of that brief discourse to Bahya. Tasmatihate bahya evam sikhitabbam dithe dithamattang bhavisati sute sutamattang bhavisati mute mutamattang bhavisati vinyate vinyatamattang bhavisati evam hite bahya sikhitabbam yato khote bahya dithe dithamattang bhavisati sute sutamattang bhavisati mute mutamattang bhavisati vinyate vinyatamattang bhavisati tato tvang bahya na tena yato tvang bahya na tena tato tvang bahya na tatha yato tvang bahya na tatha tato tvang bahya ne vidha na hurang na ubhayamantarena esevanto dukkhasse. Well then bahya, you had better train yourself thus. In the seen there will be just the seen, in the heard there will be just the heard, in the sensed there will be just the sensed, in the cognized there will be just the cognized. Thus bahya should you train yourself. And when into you bahya there will be in the seen just the seen, in the heard just the heard, in the sensed just the sensed, in the cognized just the cognized, then bahya you will not be by it. And when bahya you are not by it, then bahya you are not in it. And when bahya you are not in it, then bahya you are neither here nor there nor in between. This itself is the end of suffering. As a clue to an exegesis of this discourse, we made an attempt the other day to unravel the meaning of the two puzzling terms in the text, namely na tena and na tatha. These two terms are apparently unrelated to the context. To get at their significance, we brought up a quotation of two lines from the Jara Sutta of the Attakavagga of the Sutta Nipata. Dhono nahi tena manyati yadidam titta sutam mutesuva. Dhona is a term for the arahant in the sense that he has shaken off the dust of defilements. So then, these two lines imply that the arahant does not imagine thereby, namely yadidam, in terms of whatever is seen, heard or sensed. These two lines are, as it were, a random exegesis of our riddle terms in the Bahya Sutta. The first line itself gives the clue to the rather elliptical term natena, which carries no verb with it. Our quotation makes it clear that the implication is manyana or imagining. Dhono nahi tena manyati. The arahant does not imagine by it or thereby. Although the Bahya Sutta makes no mention of the word manyana, this particular expression seems to suggest that what is implied here is a form of imagining. By way of further proof, we may allude to another quotation, which we had to bring up several times. Yena yena hi manyanti tato tanhoti anyatha. In whatever terms they imagine it, thereby it turns otherwise. We came across another expression which has a similar connotation. Tenacha ma manyi. Do not be vain thereby. The first thing we can infer, therefore, from the above quote two lines of the verse is that what is to be understood by the elliptical expression natena in the Bahya Sutta is the idea of imagining, or in short, natena manyati, does not imagine thereby. Secondly, as to what precisely is implied by the word tena or by it can also be easily inferred from those two lines. In fact, the second line beginning with the word yadidam, which means namely or that is, looks like a commentary on the first line itself. The dhono or the arahant does not imagine thereby, namely by whatever is seen, heard and sensed. The verse in question mentions only the three terms ditta, sutta and mutta, whereas the Bahya Sutta has as its framework the four terms ditta, sutta, mutta and vinyata. Since what precedes the term natena in the Bahya Sutta is the fourfold premise beginning with ditthe dittamattam bhavisati, when to you Bahya there will be in the seen just the seen, it stands to reason that what the Buddha meant by the term natena is the attitude of not thinking in terms of whatever is seen, heard, sensed or cognized, that is to say, not imagining thereby. This same attitude of not imagining thereby is what is upheld in the Mulapariyaya Sutta, which we discussed at length on a previous occasion. There we explained the term manyana, me-thinking, imagining, taking as a paradigm the first term pathavi, occurring in the list of 24 terms given there. Among the 24 terms, we find mentioned the four relevant to our present problem, namely ditta, sutta, mutta and vinyata. We are now used to the general schema of the Mulapariyaya Sutta concerning the attitude of the three categories of persons mentioned there. Let us, for instance, take up what is said in that context with regard to the sekha or the monk in higher training. Pathavim pathavito abhinyaya pathavim mamanyi, pathaviya mamanyi, pathavito mamanyi, pathavim meti mamanyi, pathavim ma abhinandi. This is how the attitude of the sekha is described with regard to pathavi or earth. Suppose we substitute ditta or the seeing in place of pathavi. This is what we should get. Dittham dittato abhinyaya dittham mamanyi, dittasmi mamanyi, dittato mamanyi, dittham meti mamanyi, dittham ma abhinandi. What the sekha has before him is a step of training. And this is how he has to train in respect of the four things, the seen, the heard, the sensed and the cognized. He should not imagine in terms of them. For instance, he understands through higher knowledge and not through the ordinary perception of the worldly. The seen as seen, having thus understood it, he has to train in not imagining the seen as a thing by objectifying it. Dittham mamanyi, let him not imagine a scene. Also, let him not imagine in the scene or from the scene. We have already pointed out the relationship between these imaginings and the grammatical structure. This objectification of the scene gives rise to accusative tendencies. To imagine the scene as mine, dittham meti mamanyi, let him not imagine I have seen or I have a scene. This acquisition has something congratulatory about it. It leads to some sort of joy. So the monk in higher training has to combat that too. Dittham ma abhinandi, let him not delight in the scene. It seems then that the Buddha has addressed the ascetic Bahya Dharicirya in the language of the Aryans. For the very first instruction given to him was, in the scene there will be just the scene. So highly developed in wisdom and quick-witted was Bahya that the Buddha promptly asked him to stop short at the scene by understanding that in the scene there is just the scene. Not to have imaginings or me-thinkings about the seeing is therefore the way to stop short at just the seeing. If one does not stop short at just the seeing, but goes on imagining in terms of in the seeing, from the seeing, etc., as already stated, one will end up with an identification or thammeta. In our last sermon, we brought up the term thammeta. When one starts imagining in such terms about something, one tends to become one with it, tammayo. Even as things made out of gold and silver are called golden, swarnamaya and silvery, rajatamaya. It is as if one who grasps a gem becomes its owner, and if anything happens to the gem, he is affected by it. To possess the gem is to be possessed by it. When one gets attached and becomes involved and entangled in the scene through craving, conceit and views, by imagining egoistically, the result is identification, tammeta, literally of thatness. In this present context, however, the Buddha puts bahya dharucharya on the path to non-identification, or atammeta. That is to say, he advises bahya not to indulge in such imaginings. That attitude leads to non-identification and detachment. When one has no attachments, involvements and entanglements regarding the seeing, one does not have the notion of being in the scene. Once we spoke about a children's hut into which the mother was invited. When she crept into that plaything of a hut, she did not seriously entertain the thought of being in it. Similarly, if one does not indulge in imaginings, one has no notion of being in the scene. This then is the significance of the words natat, not in it. Yato tvang bahya natena, tato tvang bahya natat. When bahya you are not by it, then bahya you are not in it. That is to say, when for instance bahya does not imagine by the seeing, he is not in the seeing. Likewise, he is not in the heard, sensed or cognized. From this we can deduce the meaning of what follows. Yato tvang bahya na tatha, tato tvang bahya nevidha na hura na ubhyamantarena. At whatever moment you neither imagine by the seeing, no entertain the notion of being in the scene, which is tantamount to projecting an eye into the scene, then you are neither here nor there nor in between. In a number of earlier sermons, we have sufficiently explained the significance of the two ends and the middle, as well as the above, the below and the across in the middle. What do they signify? As we happened to point out on an earlier occasion, it is by driving the peg of the conceit M that a world is measured out, construed or postulated. We also pointed out that the grammatical structure springs up along with it. That is to say, together with the notion M, there arises a here. Here am I, he is there, and you are yon or in front of me. This is the basic ground plan for the grammatical structure known to grammar as the first person, the second person, and the third person. A world comes to be measured out and a grammatical structure springs up. This, in fact, is the origin of proliferation or papancha. So it is the freedom from that proliferation that is meant by the expression nevidha na hura na ubhyamantarena. Neither here nor there nor between the two. The notion of one's being in the world, or the bifurcation as I and the world, is no longer there. Esevanto dukkhas, this then is the end of suffering, Nibbana. The fundamental first principles underlying this short exhortation of the Buddha could thus be inferred to some extent. We could perhaps elicit something more regarding the significance of the four key terms in question. In the section of the fourth, in the Anguttara Nikaya, we come across four modes of noble usages. Chattaro Aryavohara, namely Ditthe Ditthavadita, Sute Sutavadita, Mute Mutavadita, Vinyate Vinyatavadita. These four are asserting the fact of having seen in regard to the seen, asserting the fact of having heard in regard to the heard, asserting the fact of having sensed in regard to the sensed, asserting the fact of having cognized in regard to the cognized. Generally speaking, these four noble usages stand for the principle of truthfulness. In some discourses, as well as in the Vinaya Pitaka, these terms are used in that sense. They are the criteria of the veracity of a statement in general, not so much in a deep sense. However, there are different levels of truth. In fact, truthfulness is a question of giving evidence that runs parallel with one's level of experience. At higher levels of experience or realization, the evidence one gives also changes accordingly. The episode of Venerable Mahathisa Thera is a case in view. When he met a certain woman on his way who displayed her teeth in a wily giggle, he simply grasped the sign of her teeth. He did not totally refrain from grasping a sign, but took it as an illustration of his meditation subject. Later, when that woman's husband, searching for her, came up to him and asked whether he had seen a woman, he replied that all he saw was a skeleton. Now that is a certain level of experience. Similarly, the concept of truthfulness is something that changes with levels of experience. There are various degrees of truth based on realization. The highest among them is called Paramasatya. As to what that is, the Dhatavibhanga Sutta itself provides the answer in the following statement of the Buddha. Etanyi bhikkhu paramang arya satyam yadidam amosa dhammam nibbana. Mass, this is the highest noble truth, namely nibbana, that is of a non-falsifying nature. All other truths are falsified when the corresponding level of experience is transcended. But Nibbana is the highest truth, since it can never be falsified by anything beyond it. The fact that it is possible to give evidence by this highest level of experience comes to light in the Chabbidsodhana Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. In this discourse, we find the Buddha instructing the monks as to how they should interrogate a fellow monk who claims to have attained Arhantu. The interrogation has to follow certain criteria, one of which concerns the four standpoints, ditta, sutta, mutta and vinyata, the seen, the heard, the sensed and the cognized. What sort of answer a monk who rightly claims to Arhantu would give is also stated there by the Buddha. It runs as follows. Ditte ko aham auso anupayo, anapayo, anisito, appatibaddho, vipamutto, visanyutto, vimaryadikatena chetasa viharami. Here then is the highest mode of giving evidence in the court of reality as an arahant. Friends, with regard to the seeing, I dwell unattracted, unrepelled, dependent, uninvolved, released, unshackled, with a mind free from barriers. He is unattracted, anupayo, by lust, and unrepelled, anapayo, by hate. He is not dependent, anisito, on cravings, conceits, and views. He is not involved, appatibaddho, with desires and attachments, and is released, vipamutto, from defilements. He is no longer shackled, visangyutto, by fetters, and his mind is free from barriers. What these barriers are, we can easily infer. They are the bifurcations such as the internal and the external, ajata bahidha, which are so basic to what is called existence, bhava. Where there are barriers, there are also attachments, aversions and conflicts. Where there is offense, there is defense and offense. So the Arahant dwells with the mind unpartitioned and barrierless, vimaryadikatena chetasa. To be able to make such a statement is the highest standard of giving evidence in regard to the Four Noble Usages. It is also noteworthy that in the Bahya Sutta, the Buddha has presented the triple training of higher morality, higher concentration and higher wisdom, adhisila, adhichitta and adhipanya, through these Four Noble Usages. The commentary too accepts this fact, but this is a point that might need clarification. How are we to distinguish between morality, concentration, and wisdom in this brief exhortation? Now, how does the exhortation begin? It opens with the words, Tasma tihate bahya evam sikhitabba. Well then, bahya, you should train yourself thus. This is an indication that the Buddha introduced him to a course of training, and this is the preliminary training. Ditthe dittamattang bhavisati, sute sutamattang bhavisati, mute mutamattang bhavisati, vinyate vinyatamattang bhavisati. In the seen, there will be just the seen. In the heard, there will be just the heard. In the sense, there will be just the sensed. In the cognized, there will be just the cognized. What is hinted at by this initial instruction is the training in higher morality, adhisila sikha. The most important aspect of this training is the morality of sense restraint, indriya sangvara sila. The first principles of sense restraint are already implicit in this brief instruction. If one stops short at just the seen in regard to the seen, one does not grasp a sign in it or dwell on its details. There is no sorting out as this is good, this is bad. That itself conduces to sense restraint. So we may conclude that the relevance of this brief instruction to the morality of sense restraint is in its enjoining the abstention from grasping a sign or dwelling on the details. This is what pertains to the training in higher morality, adhisila sikha. Let us see how it also serves the purpose of training in higher concentration. To stop at just the seen in the seen is to refrain from discursive thought, which is the way to abandon mental hindrances. It is discursive thought that brings hindrances in its train. So here we have what is relevant to the training in higher concentration as well. Then what about higher wisdom, adhipanya? Something more specific has to be said in this concern. What precisely is to be understood by higher wisdom in this context? It is actually the freedom from imaginings, manyana, and proliferation, papancha. If one stops short at just the seen in the seen, such ramifications as mentioned in discourses like the Mula Pariyaya Sutta do not come in at all. The tendency to objectify the seen and to proliferate it as in it, from it, and it is mine, receives no sanction. This course of training is helpful for the emancipation of the mind from imaginings and proliferation. The Buddha has compared the six sense bases, that is, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and mind, to a deserted village. Sunya midang attenava attanyenava. This is void of a self or anything belonging to a self. All these sense bases are devoid of a self or anything belonging to a self. Therefore, they are comparable to a deserted village, a village from which all inhabitants have fled. The dictum, in the seen there will be just the seen, is an advice conducive to the attitude of regarding the six sense bases as a deserted village. This is what pertains to high wisdom in the Buddha's exhortation. Papancha or prolific conceptualization is a process of transaction with whatever is seen, heard, sensed, etc. So here there is no process of such transaction. Also, when one trains oneself according to the instruction, in the seen there will be just the seen, in the heard there will be just the heard, in the sensed there will be just the sensed, in the cognized there will be just the cognized, that identification implied by the term tamyata will no longer be there. Egotism, the conceit am, and all what prompts conceptual proliferation will come to an end. This kind of training uproots the peg of the conceit am, thereby bringing about the cessation of prolific conceptualization, the cessation of becoming, the cessation of suffering. We can therefore conclude that the entire triple training is enshrined in this exhortation. What happens as a result of this training is indicated by the riddle-like terms na tena, na tatha, na vidha, na huram, na ubhyamantarena. When the wisdom of the ascetic Bahya Dharichirya had sufficiently matured by following the triple course of training, the Buddha gave the hint necessary for realization of that cessation of becoming which is Nibbana in the following words. Then Bahya you will not be by it, And when bahya you are not by it, then bahya you are not in it. And when bahya you are not in it, then bahya you are neither here nor there nor in between. This itself is the end of suffering. This sermon, therefore, is one that succinctly presents the quintessence of the Saddhamma. It is said that the mind of the ascetic Bahya Dharuchirya was released from all influxes immediately on hearing this exhortation. Now let us come back to the sequence of events in the story as mentioned in the Udana. It was after the Buddha had already set out on his alms round that this sermon was almost wrung from him with much insistence. When it had proved its worth, the Buddha continued with his alms round. Just then, cow with a young calf gored the Arahant Bahya Dharuchirya to death. While returning from his alms round with a group of monks, the Buddha saw the corpse of the Arahant Bahya. He asked those monks to take the dead body on a bed and cremate it. He even told them to build a cairn enshrining his relics, saying, "Monks, a co-celibate of yours has passed away." Those monks, having carried out the instructions, came back and reported to the Buddha. Then they raised the question, "Where has he gone after death? What is his after-death state?" The Buddha replied, "Monks, Bahya Dharuchirya was wise. He lived up to the norm of the Dhamma. He did not harass me with questions on Dhamma. Monks, Bahya Dharuchirya has attained Parinibbana." In conclusion, the Buddha uttered the following verse of uplift. Yattha pocha pathavi tejo vayo nagadhati natattha sukha jyotanti adicho na prakasati natattha chandima bhati tamo tattha na vidyati yada chattana vedi muni monena brahmano atharupa arupa cha sukha dukha pamuchyati. On the face of it, the verse seems to imply something like this. Where water, earth, fire and air do not find a footing, there the stars do not shine and the sun spreads not its luster. The moon does not appear resplendent there and no darkness is to be found there. When the sage, the Brahmin with wisdom, understands by himself, then is he freed from form and formless, and from pleasure and pain as well. The commentary to the Udana, Paramattha Deepani, gives a strange interpretation to this verse. It interprets the verse as a description of the destination of the Arahant Bahya Dharuchirya after he attained Parinibbana, the place he went to. Even the term Nibbana Gati is used in this connection, the place one goes to in attaining Parinibbana. That place, according to the commentary, is not easily understood by worldlings. Its characteristics are said to be the following. The four elements, earth, water, fire and air, are not there. No sun or moon or stars are there. The reason why the four elements are negated is supposed to be the fact that there is nothing that is compounded in the uncompounded Nibbana element into which the Arahant passes away. Since no sun or moon or stars are there in that mysterious place, one might wonder why there is no darkness either. The commentator tries to forestall the objection by stating that it is precisely because one might think that there should be darkness when those luminaries are not there that the Buddha emphatically negates it. So the commentarial interpretation apparently leads to the conclusion that there is no darkness in the Nibbana element, even though no sun or moon or stars are there. The line of interpretation we have followed throughout this series of sermons allows us to depart from this commentarial trend. That place where earth, water, fire and air do not find a footing is not where the Arahant Bahya Dharuchirya had gone when he passed away. The commentator seems to have construed this verse as a reply the Buddha gave to the question raised by those monks. Their question was, "Where has he gone after death? What is his after-death state?" They were curious about his bone. But when we carefully examine the context, it becomes clear that they raised that question because they did not know that the corpse they cremated was that of an Arahant. Had they known it, they would not have even asked that question. That is precisely the reason for the Buddha's declaration that Bahya attained Parinibbana, a fact he had not disclosed before. He added that Bahya followed the path of Dhamma without harassing him with questions and attained Parinibbana. Now that is the answer, Prabhupada. To reveal the fact that Bahya attained Parinibbana is to answer the question put by those inquisitive monks. Obviously, they knew enough of the Dhamma to understand then that their question about the born and destiny of Venerable Bahya was totally irrelevant. So then, the verse uttered by the Buddha in conclusion was something extra. It was only a joyous utterance, a verse of uplift, coming as a grand finale to the whole episode. Such verses of uplift are often to be met with in the Udana. As we already mentioned, the verses in the Udana have to be interpreted very carefully, because they go far beyond the implications of the story concerned. They invite us to take a plunge into the ocean of Dhamma. Just one verse is enough. The text is small but deep. The verse in question is such a spontaneous utterance of joy. It is not the answer to the question, where did he go? Well, in that case, what are we to understand by the word yath, where? We have already given a clue to it in our seventh sermon with reference to that non-manifestative consciousness, Anidarsana Vijnana. What the Buddha describes in this verse is not the place where the Venerable Anahata Bahya went after his demise, but the non-manifestative consciousness he had realized here and now in his concentration of the fruit of Arahanthood, or Arahatta Phala Samadhi. Let us hark back to the four lines quoted in the Kevaddha Sutta. Vinyanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham yath apocha pathvi tejo vayo nagadhati. Consciousness which is non-manifestative, endless lustrous on all sides. It is here that water and earth, fire and air, no footing find. The first two lines of the verse in the Bahya Sutta, beginning with the correlative yath, where find an answer in the last two lines quoted above from the Kevaddha Sutta. What is referred to as it is here is obviously the non-manifestative consciousness mentioned in the first two lines. That problematic place indicated by the word yath, where in the Bahya Sutta is none other than this non-manifestative consciousness. We had occasion to explain at length in what sense earth, water, fire and air find no footing in that consciousness. The ghostly elements do not haunt that consciousness. That much is clear. But how are we to understand the enigmatic reference to the sun, the moon and the stars? It is said that the stars do not shine in that non-manifestative consciousness. The sun does not spread its luster, and the moon does not appear resplendent in it, nor is there any darkness. How are we to construe all this? Briefly stated, the Buddha's declaration amounts to the revelation that the sun, the moon and the stars fade away before the superior radiance of the non-manifestative consciousness, which is infinite and lustrous on all sides. How a lesser radiance fades away before a superior one, we have already explained with reference to the cinema in a number of earlier sermons. To sum up, the attention of the audience in a cinema is directed to the narrow beam of light falling on the screen. The audience or the spectators are seeing the scenes making up the film show with the help of that beam of light and the thick darkness around. This second factor is also very important. Scenes appear not simply because of the beam of light. The thickness of the darkness around is also instrumental in it. This fact is revealed when the cinema hall is fully lit up. If the cinema hall is suddenly illuminated, either by the opening of doors and windows or by some electrical device, the scenes falling on the screen fade away as if they were erased. The beam of light which was earlier there becomes dim before the superior light. The lesser luster is superseded by a greater luster. We might sometimes be found fault with for harping on this cinema simile on the ground that it impinges on the precept concerning abstinence from enjoying dramatic performances, song and music. But let us consider whether this cinema is something confined to a cinema hall. In the open-air theater of the world before us, a similar phenomenon of supersedence is occurring. In the twilight glow of the evening, the twinkling stars enable us to faintly figure out the objects around us despite the growing darkness. Then the moon comes up. Now what happens to the twinkling little stars? They fade away, their luster being superseded by that of the moon. Then we begin to enjoy the charming scenes before us in the serene moonlit night. The night passes on. The daylight gleam of the sun comes up. What happens then? The soft radiance of the moon wanes before the majestic luster of the sun. The moon gets superseded and fades away. Full of confidence, we are now watching the multitude of technicolored scenes in this massive theater of the world. In broad daylight, when sunshine is there, we have no doubt about our vision of objects around us. But now let us suppose that the extraneous defilements in the mind of a noble disciple treading the noble eightfold path get dispelled, allowing its intrinsic luster of wisdom to shine forth. What happens then? The stars, the moon and the sun get superseded by that light of wisdom. Even the forms that one had seen by twilight, moonlight and sunlight fade away and pale into insignificance. The umbra of form and the penumbra of the formless get fully erased. In the previous sermon, we happened to mention that form and space are related to each other like the picture and its background. Now, all this is happening in the firmament, which forms the background. We could enjoy the scenes of the world cinema because of their darkness. The twilight, the moonlight and the sunlight are but various levels of their darkness. The whirling things that one who has eyes must surely see if there is sunshine. He cannot think of anything beyond it. But the Buddha has declared that there is something more radiant than the radiance of the sun. Natthi panya sama abha. There is no radiance comparable to wisdom. Let us hark back to a declaration by the Buddha we had already quoted in a previous sermon. Tatasso ima bhikkhave pabha. Katama chatasso, chanda pabha, surya pabha, akti pabha, panya pabha, ima kho bhikkave chatasso pabha, etadaggam bhikkave imasang chatunnam pabhana, yadidam panya pabha. Monks, there are these four lusters. What for? The luster of the moon, the luster of the sun, the luster of fire, the luster of wisdom. These monks are the four lusters. This monk is the highest among these four lusters, namely the luster of wisdom. So then, we can now understand why the form and the formless fade away. This wisdom has a penetrative quality, for which reason it is called Nibbedhika Panya. When one sees forms, one sees them together with their shadows. The fact that one sees shadows there is itself proof that darkness has not been fully displayed. If light comes from all directions, there is no shadow at all. If that light is of a penetrative nature, not even form will be manifest there. Now, it is mainly due to what is called form and formless, rupa, arupa, that the worldling experiences pleasure and pain in a world that distinguishes between a pleasure and pain. Though we have departed from the commentarial path of exegesis, we are now in a position to interpret the cryptic verse in the Bhāja Sutta perhaps more meaningfully. Let us now recall the verse in question. Yattha āpoche pathavi tejo vāyo nagādhati na tattha sukha jyotanti ādicho na pakāsati na tattha chandimā bhāti tamo tattha na vijyati yadā chattanā vedi muni moni na brahmano atha rūpā arūpā ca sukha dukha pamuchati. The verse can be fully explained along the lines of interpretation we have adopted. By way of further proof of the inadequacy of the commentarial explanation of the references to the sun, the moon and the stars in this verse, we may draw attention to the following points.
According to the commentary, the verse is supposed to express that there are no sun, moon or stars in that mysterious place called Anupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu, which is incomprehensible to worldlings. We may, however, point out that the verbs used in the verse in this connection do not convey the sense that the sun, the moon and the stars are simply non-existent there. They have something more to say. For instance, with regard to the stars, it is said that there the stars do not shine. Natattha sukha jyotanti. If in truth and fact the stars are not there, some other verb like nadisanti, are not seen, or navijyanti, do not exist, could have been used. With reference to the sun and the moon also, similar verbs could have been employed. But what we actually find here are verbs expressive of spreading light, shining, or appearing beautiful. Natattha sukha jyotanti, there the stars do not shine. Adichyo napakasati, the sun spreads not its luster. Natattha chandima bhati, the moon does not appear resplendent there. These are not mere prosaic statements. The verse in question is a joyous utterance, udana gatha, of extraordinary depth. There is nothing recondite about it. In our early assessment of the commentarial interpretation, he happened to lay special stress on the words even though. We are now going to explain the significance of that emphasis. For the commentary, the line tamo tattha navijyati, no darkness is to be found there, is a big riddle. The sun, the moon and the stars are not there. Even though they are not there, presumably no darkness is to be found there. However, when we consider the law of superseding we have already mentioned, we are compelled to give a totally different interpretation. The sun, the moon and the stars are not manifest precisely because of the light of that non-manifestative consciousness. As it is lustrous on all sides, sabbato pabha, there is no darkness there and luminaries like the stars, the sun and the moon do not shine there. This verse of uplift thus reveals a wealth of information relevant to our topic. Not only the exhortation to bahya, but this verse also throws a flood of light on the subject of Nibbana. That extraordinary place which the commentary often identifies with the term Anupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu is this mind of ours. It is in order to indicate the luminosity of this mind that the Buddha used those peculiar expressions in this verse of uplift. What actually happens in the attainment to the fruit of Anantut? The worldling discerns the world around him with the help of six narrow beams of light, namely the six sense bases. When the superior luster of wisdom arises, those six sense bases go down. This cessation of the six sense bases could also be referred to as the cessation of name and form, nama rupa nirodha, or the cessation of consciousness, vijnana nirodha. The cessation of the six sense bases does not mean that one does not see anything. What one sees then is voidness. It is an insight. He gives expression to it with the words sunyo loko, void is the world. What it means is that all the sense objects which the worldling grasps as real and truly existing get penetrated through with wisdom and become non-manifest. If we are to add something more to this interpretation of the Bahya Sutta by way of review, we may say that this discourse illustrates the six qualities of the Dhamma, namely Svakkhato, well proclaimed, Sandittiko, visible here and now, Akaliko, timeless, Ehipassiko, inviting to come and see, Opanaiko, leading onward, and Pachyattang Vedita Bovinyohi, to be realized by the wise each one by himself. These six qualities are wonderfully exemplified by this discourse. In a previous sermon, we had occasion to bring up a simile of a dewdrop dazzling in the morning sunshine. The task of seeing the spectrum of rainbow colors through a tiny dewdrop hanging from a creeper or leaf is one that calls for a high degree of mindfulness. Simply by standing or sitting with one's face towards this rising sun, one will not be able to catch a glimpse of the brilliant spectrum of rainbow colors through the dewdrop. it requires a particular viewpoint. Only when one focuses on that viewpoint can one see it. So it is with the spectrum of the six qualities of the Dhamma. Here too, the correct viewpoint is a must, and that is right view. Reflection on the meaning of deep discourses helps one to straighten up right view. Where right view is lacking, morality inclines towards dogmatic attachment to rituals, sila bhata paramas. Concentration turns out to be wrong concentration, michcha samadhi. Like the one who sits facing the sun, one might be looking in the direction of the Dhamma, but right view is not something one inherits by merely going to the refuge of the Buddha. It has to be developed with effort and proper attention. View is something that has to be straightened up, for the tujjukamma, the act of straightening up one's view, is reckoned as one of the 10 skillful deeds, kusalakamma. So however long one may sit with folded legs gazing at the Buddha sun, one might not be able to see the 6 rainbow colors of the Dhamma. One may be short of just 100th of an inch as the proper adjustment for right view. Yet it is a must. Once that adjustment is made, one immediately, then and there, Thavdeva catches a glimpse of the spectrum of the Dhamma that the Buddha has proclaimed. We have stressed the importance of right view in particular because many are grappling with a self-created problem concerning the proper alignment between the triple training and the right view of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, as to the triple training, morality, concentration and wisdom, we find wisdom mentioned last. It seems then that we have to perfect morality first, then develop concentration and only lastly wisdom. One need not think of wisdom before that. But when we come to the Noble Eightfold Path, we find a different order of values. Your right view takes precedence. As a matter of fact, in the Mahachattarisaka Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, we find the Buddha repeatedly declaring emphatically, Tatra bhikkave sammaditti pubbangama. Monks, therein right view takes precedence. Even in a context where the subject is morality, we find a similar statement. So how are we to resolve this issue? In the Noble Eightfold Path, pride of place is given to right view, which is representative of the wisdom group. As the well-known definition goes, right view and right thoughts belong to the wisdom group. Right speech, right action and right livelihood come under the morality group. And right effort, right mindfulness and right concentration belong to the concentration group. So in this way, in the Noble Eightfold Path, wisdom comes first, then morality and lastly concentration. But in the context of these three groups, firstly comes morality, secondly concentration and lastly wisdom. Here too, the answer given by the Arahant Nun Venerable Dhammadinna to the lay disciple Visakha comes to our aid. The lay disciple Visakha poses the following question to Venerable Dhammadinna. Aliena nukho aye attangikena maggena tayo khanda sanghaita udahu tihi khandehi aryo attangiko maggo sanghaita. Good lady, are the three groups, morality, concentration and wisdom, included by the Noble Eightfold Path, or is the Noble Eightfold Path included by the three groups? Even at that time, there may have been some who raised such questions. That is probably the reason for such a query. Then the Arahant Nan Dhammadinna answers, Nakho auso visakha aryena attangikena maggena tayo khanda sanghaita. Tihicha kho auso visakha khandehi aryo attangiko maggo sanghaita. Friend Visakha, it is not that the threefold training is included by the Noble Eightfold Path, but the Noble Eightfold Path is included by the threefold training. Since this appears to be something of a tangle, let us try to illustrate the position with some other kind of tangle. Suppose someone is trying to climb up a long rope made up of 3 strands. As he climbs up, his fingertips might come now in contact with the first strand, now with the second, and now with the third. He is not worried about the order of the 3 strands, so long as they are well knit. One can safely climb up, holding on to the 3 strands, only when they are firmly wound up into a sturdy rope. All these questions seem to have arisen due to an attitude of taking too seriously the numerical order of things. To the noble disciple climbing up the rope of the Noble Eightfold Path, there need not be any confusion between the numerical order of the Triple Training and that of the Noble Eightfold Path. But if someone taking the cue from the order of the Triple Training neglects right view or ignores its prime import, he might end up confused. All in all, we are now in a position to correctly assess the deep significance of the Bahya Sutta. Here we have the quintessence of the entire Saddham. We are not confronted with heaps of perceptual data, which we are told today are essential requisites for admission into the city of Nibbana. For the ordinary worldling, amassing a particular set of percepts or concepts seems a qualification for entering Nibbana. But what we have here is a way of liberating the mind even from latencies to percepts. Confer, sanya nanusenti, Madhupindika Sutta. Perceptions do not lie latent. There is no heaping up anew. What are called extraneous taints, agantuka upaklesa, are not confined to the well-known defilements in the world. They include all the rust and dust we have been collecting throughout this long samsara with the help of the influxes, asava. They include even the heap of percepts which the world calls knowledge. Even numerals are part of it. The Buddha has briefly expressed here the mode of practice for disabusing the mind from all such taints. Therefore, there is no reason for underestimating the value of this discourse by calling it Vohara Desana, conventional teaching. This discourse in the Udana is one that is truly uplifting. It indeed deserves a pearl of joy.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible, free of charge, to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.